It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, here's a challenge for you. If you had to come up with a mathematical formula to predict the spread of nicotine use among teens, would you even know where to begin? I wouldn't. We'll talk with some high school students from Milwaukee about their very impressive showing in a nationwide math contest. First, if I asked you about the big policy priorities of Republicans and Democrats, you'd probably have two very different answers. For Republicans, you might mention tax and spending cuts. For Democrats, you'd probably point to spending on social programs like Medicaid. Our next guest says both sides should try to match their priorities with a real effort to get the national debt under control. And he says it's possible to make important investments in the nation's future and bring down the annual deficit at the same time. William Gale is an economist with the Brookings Institution. He also co-directs their Tax Policy Center, and he's the author of the new book, Fiscal Therapy, Curing America's Debt Addiction and Investing in the Future. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the annual deficit and the overall national debt. Why do you think politicians of both parties should be paying more attention?
Basically, things are okay right now. The economy's doing well. But if you look forward, and you don't have to look forward that far, we're facing rising and permanent deficits and permanently increasing debt relative to the size of the economy. That's ultimately unsustainable, and the sooner we do something about it, the easier and less abrupt the policy changes will have to be.
And you're not looking in your proposals in your book to necessarily zero out the national debt. You just want to bring it to a sustainable level. Is that right?
That's correct. There's no gain, and in fact, there's some loss in eliminating the debt. Debt serves some useful purposes. It helps us, you know, if we want to borrow money to fight a recession or finance a war or finance new social initiatives, we need debt to do that. So there's good debt and there's bad debt. The debt that we're accumulating is the bad kind. It's going to go increasingly to finance transfer payments and consumption rather than investment.
And you point out in the book that this is kind of a weird situation to be in with a long-term debt. In the past, we've had debts to do things like engage in really big wars like World War II, or to help us ride out, as you just mentioned, a recession. We're not really exactly doing either of those right now.
Right. Well, that's what's troubling. That's the glass half empty part of the current situation. The economy is doing great, but the deficit is still rising and the debt is still rising. So that if that's happening during the best of times, you know, you can imagine what will happen if the economy turns down. What seems like an ignorable problem right now could all of a sudden become a very big one.
But that's only part one of the problem you lay out in your book, that growing national debt. The other problem is, you say, even though we're racking up this debt, we're not making investments, needed investments that we need now to ensure a better future. What kind of things are you looking at there?
Well, there are some obvious issues like the lack of infrastructure investment. And you saw earlier this week that the president and the Democrats agree in principle, at least, to a massive infrastructure agenda. But our scientific research, our R&D, has also plummeted over time. And was a big part, I think, and others think about what helped the economy so much in the post-World War II era. And then if you look at a variety of social initiatives, investment in kids, investment in education, in making work pay, you can argue, I think, very reasonably that those should be thought of as investments as well, rather than just spending initiatives. And so I think we need to, as a country, invest more in kids. They are our next generation, and we're just missing opportunities to get them the education and the training and the skills that they need to make our economy work better.
Talking to William Gale about his new book, Fiscal Therapy, Curing America's Debt Addiction and Investing in the Future. Okay, there's our two-part problem, Bill, laid out. Growing debt, need to invest in the future. But how can we do both of those at the same time? That's what most of your book is about. Spell out the basics for us.
Sure. There's three components to the solution. One, as you mentioned, is investing more in children and infrastructure and so on. The second is there's no way to avoid reforming the major entitlement programs, Social Security and Medicare. They're an enormous part of the budget, and we're not going to be able to reduce spending, you know, by cutting government workers' salaries or eliminating the Department of Commerce or those type of things. Where the money is Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and the military. And if we want to find spending cuts, we're going to need to focus there. And the third part is basically we need to raise taxes, and in the process we need to reform the tax system to make it both more efficient and more equitable.
Let's before we take those in turn, let's look at the political challenge there. Saying we need to raise taxes is a non-starter for a lot of people in Congress and their core constituencies. Saying we have to make changes to Social Security and Medicaid if it involves any kind of cuts, well, that's hard to sell. How do you make a political case that's going to bring in people who are going to be almost instinctively opposed to at least part of what you just said?
I think that's a great question. Clearly, the politics are hard, and interestingly, the biggest moving parts, the taxes and Social Security and Medicare, are also the things where people feel most strongly about it. So it's not an accident that we ended up in the particular situation that we're in. But I think I think ultimately we need somebody to lead on this. We need a political leader who is willing to take the mantle and emphasize that what we are talking about is the welfare of our children and their children, that attaining a reasonable budget should be both a conservative and a liberal goal. And that there's a lot to be gained from fiscal reform, making the economy stronger, making it fairer, investing, you know, in everything from roads to children. So there's a lot to be gained, but, you know, the laws of arithmetic can't be repealed. If we want those things, we have to pay.
You point out that the people who will be most affected by a debt crunch whenever it happens are probably not old enough to vote yet. How do you make the case to the American public that we would need to make some sacrifices now, pay a little higher taxes maybe, risk cuts to our own Social Security payments down the road maybe, on behalf of this next generation?
It's a hard thing to do. Nobody wants to be the sucker left holding the bag and bearing the costs when everyone else gets off scot-free. So and part of the problem now is sort of the broader political situation where the two sides don't trust each other. But I think the key is to keep our eye on the prize, which is a better future. I mean, in a way it sounds cliche, but that's what we're talking about, the ability of society to generate higher standards of living, the ability of society to generate opportunity for people to move up the income ladder, and so on. And so I feel like the fiscal reforms will be necessary, but we can use them as an opportunity to achieve these other goals that we all think are appropriate goals.
Talking to William Gale, economist and budget expert with the Brookings Institution. His new book is Fiscal Therapy, Curing America's Debt Addiction and Investing in the Future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of our taxing and spending priorities in the country? Are you worried about the long-term impact of the national debt, whether it's going to hit you or your kids or your grandkids' generation? Do you see there being a fair way to invest in social programs and deal with the national debt? Would you be willing to vote for someone who said, yep, we're going to raise taxes some, we're going to make some cuts to Social Security in the interest of bringing down the deficit and investing in social programs for the future, investments in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Bill Gale from the Brookings Institution about ways he says lawmakers can get America off of its reliance on big and growing debt and invest in social programs that help the public at the same time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think a system that's fair to each generation, current and future, would look like? If you're a millennial or younger, are you worried about the impact the national debt could have on you, maybe cuts, risks to your Social Security in the future? Do you have questions for our guest about what he wants to do about taxes, spending, and more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Bill, before we go to our callers, let's dig into what you're looking at with taxes. What are some of the changes you think we could be making now?
Well, these are interestingly changes that would be good ideas even if we didn't have a long-term fiscal issue. The most obvious thing we need to do in the tax side is implement a carbon tax to reduce carbon emissions and start dealing with climate change. I don't think it's enough to deal with climate change, but it's a significant carbon tax would be an important first step. And then income tax reform, basically, if you close loopholes, you can raise a significant amount of money among high-income taxpayers just by closing loopholes without raising rates. And similarly, with enforcing the tax system better, we could raise a significant amount of money. One out of every six tax dollars that are owed in a country are not paid. And the total every year is about $500 billion, which is more than we raise from the corporate income tax, for example. So there's a lot of tax evasion that we can go after. And then the linchpin in all this is we need to follow the lead of the rest of the world and establish a value-added tax, which is basically a national consumption tax.
Let's bring on our callers now. Grant is with us in Minocqua. Grant, hello.
Hello. My question, I guess, or comment to this section would be, how can you ask the American people or these people to make the sacrifices when Congress or the House of Representatives, when they continue to pass bills and spend money at a rate that's unsustainable? A lot of people, I believe, would be willing to help the cause if they knew it was going to fix the problem, but they just can't seem to grasp that spending. They can't get a hold on their own spending.
Grant, thanks for the call. What do you think, Bill?
That's a great question, and it goes back to this notion about the two sides don't trust each other. So you hear people say exactly what the caller said, I don't want to pay more taxes if they're just going to turn around and spend it. And so there's two ways to deal with that. One is to earmark new taxes for particular purposes. So like, say, we're going to have a value-added tax, and it's only going to pay for, say, health care. The other thing to do is to do what they did in the 80s and 90s, which is reach budget deals, bipartisan budget deals, where they raise taxes and cut spending. Not only do you have assurance that the increase in tax is not going to increase spending, it's reducing spending, but also because if the deal were bipartisan, you would have some security knowing that going forward, it wouldn't be undone. A lot of the stuff that gets undone, like Obamacare, is stuff that got voted on in a very partisan fashion.
Thanks for that call, Grant. We'll go now to Chris on the line in Milwaukee. Chris, hi.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is because I actually have been doing some research on Social Security and Medicare, and I was really surprised to find out that Medicare is partially paid for by general taxes, general funding. So when I've been talking to people about that, their response was, I really don't care. I paid for it. I don't want any cuts. I don't want any more taxes. And basically, it was the Republicans who were saying this. And, you know, you could say, but it comes, you know, you're paying for it with general taxes and it's going to affect your kids. And the response that I got was, I could care less. I earned this. So I just don't have a lot of hope at this point.
Chris, thanks for the call. Bill, what do you say to Chris's skepticism there?
It's another interesting comment. Medicare, part of it is paid out of a trust fund and payroll taxes, and part of it is paid from general revenues. And this feeling that people have that they've paid Medicare taxes their whole life and they've earned it is a very legitimate one, although the taxes only apply to one of the several parts of Medicare. But with both Social Security and Medicare, polls show that a large share of the population would rather raise taxes to sustain those programs than would prefer to cut benefits.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Joanne with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. What I would like to ask is what your expert thinks on removing the cap from Social Security wages. You know what I'm talking about?
Presumably the payroll tax cap.
Mm-hmm. I assume that's it. Joanne, thanks. Bill, yeah, that's often talked about when it comes to Social Security's future.
Yeah, there are three things that every serious Social Security reform plan does. One is fix the way Social Security deals with inflation. One is to raise the normal retirement age. And the third is to raise the payroll tax cap. It got set in a way many years ago that has caused Social Security not to cover as much of high-income earnings as it used to. And given that there's been so much income growth at the top, we need to reset the payroll tax cap for both for equity purposes to make sure people are paying, but also for revenue purposes, too. So I agree we need to raise the payroll tax cap.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to William Gale from the Brookings Institution about his new book. It's called Fiscal Therapy, Curing America's Debt Addiction and Investing in the Future. We'll go back to your calls now. We've got James with us in Fountain City. James, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, you know, unless I missed it someplace in the early part of this discussion with dealing with the deficit and Social Security reductions, Medicare reductions, I didn't hear any discussion about reducing the military spending, which is like the largest in the world, for crying out loud. That would affect this thing much more than reducing Social Security.
James, thanks for the call. Bill, you mentioned military spending was one of the big chunks of our spending outlays in the United States. Where does that fit into your plan?
So in the past, you know, after World War II, after World War I, we returned to fiscal sustainability by cutting military spending dramatically. But military spending, I'm sure there's some stuff we can cut from it. But it's already pretty low. It's about 3% of GDP. The caller's right. It's high relative to other countries, but it's low as a share of the economy relative to what it used to be. So, for example, even if we eliminated defense spending, totally set it to zero, it would not be large enough to offset the growth in Social Security and Medicare. So defense spending, I don't think will grow all that fast in the future, but it's not the pot of gold that, you know, we can use to balance the rest of the budget.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to CJ with us now in Duluth. CJ, hi.
Hi, thank you for the conversation and taking my call. I have some skepticism, and I'm interested in your perspective around the politics of addressing these issues. In particular, I think that the situation with corporate influence in our political system is a huge hindrance to making reasonable or responsible decisions for the future. And I would just like to hear your take on election and campaign finance reform and how that fits into this conversation. Thank you.
Bill, thanks. Campaign spending and corporate influence.
Really interesting thought. I did not go into campaign financing in the book. It seemed a little beyond the scope of what the book was about, but I agree that it's an important issue. And if you look at taxes over time, you see that corporate taxes have come way down as a share of the economy, and tax rates on high-income households have come down as a share of the economy. And this is at the same time that the public consistently thinks that taxes on high-income households and corporations should be going up. This is for 20 years, a strong majority of public and Gallup polls have said this. So there's no doubt that the caller is right, that there's enormous amount of influence of these groups in the tax policy process, then that is definitely an obstacle.
Thanks for the call. One objection, Bill, and mostly from Republicans, is the idea that, okay, if you increase taxes on wealthy Americans and particularly on corporations, you slow down their investment in the economy, you slow down their economy overall, maybe you end up hurting tax revenues as a result.
Yeah, you know, let me sigh in response to that. I mean, there's people say that so often, and I think the answer is there are ways to raise taxes that are not going to hurt the economy. A consumption tax is not going to hurt saving or investment. Closing loopholes may actually help in terms of getting people not to invest based on tax reasons. There are changes to the corporate tax that we could make that would make it more investment friendly and raise revenues. And this ideological point that we can't raise taxes because it'll kill the economy is just wrong. Let me just give you one example. The OECD, the G7 countries have had about one third higher taxes than we have had since 1970. As a share of their economy, their taxes are one third higher, but their growth rate per capita has been identical to ours. And so that sort of shows that you can raise revenues without hurting growth rate. And of course, the big tax that they have that we don't have is the value added tax, the consumption tax that I'm advocating that we implement.
In our last 30 seconds or so, Bill, we've heard skepticism from our listeners. Do you feel optimistic that this plan, something like it, could happen?
I think something like this will have to happen at some point. I mean, I share everybody's cynicism about the political system. I read the same papers and see the same things. And in a way, things may well get worse before they get better. What I mean by that is, like, if a congressman knows that he or she has to cut Social Security benefits, they're going to do everything, they're going to try everything possible to show their constituents that they did everything they could to avoid this outcome so before they actually vote to cut benefits. So we might have a whole series of crazy proposals and, you know, ideological standoffs, but I feel like ultimately we'll have to address this issue, and then we'll be basically looking for the best way to do it.
Thanks for joining us today. That was William Gale. His new book is Fiscal Therapy. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Southeastern Wisconsin has some smart math students. A team from Nicolet High School recently took part in a national competition in New York City. Out of nearly 900 teams from around the country, the Nicolet team came in third. They had to tackle a real-world issue, substance abuse. In short, they had to come up with mathematical models to gauge the spread of nicotine use from vaping and figure out how many high school seniors could be affected. The MathWorks Math Modeling Challenge, or M-Cubed, is put on each year by the Society for Industrial and Applied Mathematics. The finals took place in New York on Monday. Mike Widener is a math teacher at Nicolet High School and coach of the school's team, and Ryan Mortensen is a junior at Nicolet and a member of the school's math team. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, sure. Very happy to be here.
And Ryan, thanks to you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Ryan, you and the team, third place out of almost 900 teams from all over the country. Congratulations. How does that feel?
Thank you. It feels awesome. It's incredible. I mean, right after we won, I had to go up and speak, and I think I said I felt like I was on a cloud, which is a pretty accurate. Yeah, it's incredible. It's awesome.
Now, Mike, talk us through how this M-Cubed competition works.
Well, M-Cubed is sponsored by MathWorks, which is a company that makes modeling software. And it's organized by the Society for the Industrial and Applied Mathematics, which is a professional organization. What they do is they come up with a very complicated real-world problem that students can use math modeling to solve. The problems have three different parts. So this year's had to do with drug use and drug abuse in our country. And the three different parts, students have to use what they know about mathematics and what they know about doing research on the internet, and have to put together some models to make predictions about what will happen in the future and also what a typical class would look like. Students have 14 hours to work from the time they download the problem until their problem is due, and they can pick any 14 hours during that weekend to do the problems. Teams are organized, teams of 3, 4, or 5, 11th and 12th graders, so juniors and seniors in high school.
And Ryan, tell me about that 14-hour grind. What was that like for you and your team?
Yeah, so we got to my friend's house and went into his basement, and we sort of sat down. At that point, there were only 3 of the 4 of us present. One of our members had a Taekwondo tournament, actually. and so we were very unfamiliar with the challenge, so we spent a few hours just sort of trying to get our bearings and figuring out where we were going to start. And they ended up being very helpful those hours, and sort of we failed a lot in those hours, which helped us to sort of know what not to do and finish strong with the remaining 10 hours. And then our other member showed up and we sort of got going. We started out by collecting a ton of data that we could just use. And once we had a ton of data, we began sort of analyzing how we could fit it into mathematical formulas to predict the different aspects we were asked to predict. And so we then sort of broke off into little groups and did our own work from there.
And Ryan, as I understand it, this was in particular looking at e-cigarettes and vaping and how that might affect nicotine use among high school students. Does that feel like an issue that hits close to home that you see people struggling with actually in your high school?
Yes. Yeah. So that is something that I thought was really cool, is the competition. This M3 challenge always does problems that are related to sort of the world as it is right now. And this one for sure hit close to home. I've seen people using e-cigarettes. I know people who use them. Our school has sort of struggled with figuring out how to control that. So it was something that, I mean, A, it sort of, I think it kept our interest because it was something that we see firsthand. And then additionally, yeah, it was really cool to solve a problem that has real societal application. And the predictions we made in this problem, like over the next 10 years, we can actually look to see how good our models were, which is really cool.
Now, Mike, you're a math teacher. I'm sure you've heard the dreaded question, when am I going to use this stuff in the real world? It sounds like this contest helps demonstrate, yes, you can use this stuff in the real world.
Exactly, Rob. I think it's a age-old question for math teachers. Oftentimes, we prepare students. We get them ready. We work really hard on solving problems in a book. But no one gets hired to solve problems out of a textbook. In the real world, people have to take their math knowledge and apply it in new and unique ways. And that's why I think the SIAM, the sponsoring organization, does such a great job, because what they're doing is they're exposing high school students to this idea that math isn't always a short answer. There's not always an answer in the back of the book. There are often many different ways and many different techniques to use as we approach a complicated math problem. And, you know, as a society, as we move forward, you know, there is so much data out there. And this idea of looking at big data and looking at thousands and thousands and thousands of data points and trying to make sense out of it. We have so much data, but not really wisdom. It's getting information that's actionable, usable information from all that data that's going to be key. And we need a lot more mathematicians and computer scientists to step forward and to lead us into the future, because it is such an important, vital part of our world.
We're talking to Mike Widener, math teacher at Nicolet High School and coach of the school's team at the MathWorks Math Modeling Challenge. Also with us, Ryan Mortensen, a member of the Nicolet math team, which won 3rd place in this national competition among almost 900 teams. Now, Ryan, you're a junior. I don't want to put you in a pigeonhole just yet, but would you consider a career in math or computer science or some related field?
Certainly. Well, so we... Actually, Jane Street was, I think it's a financial firm that hosted us when we went to New York, and they talked about some of what they do, and I found that sort of fascinating. So that's something I'll certainly look at. But then the other thing is, I think what this competition has showed us is the value of math in anything you do. So even if I go into something that's seemingly completely unrelated to math, having a great basis of knowledge in math can help me to become a more skilled worker in any career path, and sort of better understand the world around me. So, yeah.
Math
will be important no matter what.
Got to have my kids listen to this interview. Now, Mike, I wanted to ask about your role as the coach of the team. What was your involvement? You were not actually in the basement, were you?
I was not. I was not allowed to be in the basement. This was something that students are totally encouraged to work on their own. Some coaches do spend time, maybe have an after-school club, and I've considered that in the past. There hasn't been a lot of interest. Now that some of our own students have gone to New York and finished in the third place in the nation, maybe we'll have more interest in the future. Some schools have practiced. What I do in my class with my calculus students, we have an AP calculus course. There's a lot of content. It's hard to fit everything in, but I take out about half of a class period and try to explain what math modeling is and why it's useful and what the M-cubed challenge is like. For some students, spending 14 hours on a problem that they don't have to do as a required part of a course sounds painful and sounds like something they're not willing to do. But Ryan came forward and said, you know, that sounds kind of interesting. I think I'd like that, and I have some friends that I think would like it too. He went away, recruited some of his friends, and four of them said, yes, we'd like to do this. We'd like to spend 14 hours. I sent a few links to the students and encouraged them to look at some websites, some past solutions to get a sense of what their problems would be like. But that was pretty much the extent of my coaching.
And Ryan, as we wrap up, I just remember the line in The Martians where Matt Damon says, I'm going to clean up the language, let's math this stuff. Having been through this experience, do you like see a problem or hear about an issue in the world and now you think, hey, let's math this. How do we figure out how that's going to play out?
Yeah, definitely. I think this has certainly shown me how math can be used to solve really any problem, even problems we don't know exist. And that quote you're referring to, I have to chuckle because I basically felt that exact way when we opened up the problem. And there were a few points throughout those 14 hours where I think my friends felt the same way, where suddenly it clicked and we're like, yeah, let's math this. Let's go for it. So it's very cool.
Well, thanks to both of you for joining us and congratulations on the big success in that contest.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mike Widener is a math teacher at Nicolet High School and coach of the school's team at the MathWorks Math Modeling Challenge. Ryan Mortensen is a member of the Nicolet math team. We talked to them about their award for best presentation and third place finish in the national competition in New York City. The team earned $10,000 in scholarship money for their efforts. A big chunk of Governor Tony Evers' proposed budget could be disappearing, at least for now. The Republican chairs of the state's Joint Finance Committee say they plan to remove 131 of Evers' proposal from the budget, including automatic voter registration, nonpartisan redistricting, and accepting federal money to expand Wisconsin's Medicaid program. Governor Evers and other Democrats held a press conference today where they asked for the public's support in pressuring Republicans in the legislature to change course on Medicaid expansion.
I know it's hard to believe, but we have to put political rhetoric behind and make sure that health care is affordable and accessible in the state of Wisconsin. 70% of the folks in the state say yes, and a whole bunch of those are Republicans. So I'm here today with a message for the people of Wisconsin. I'm going to fight like hell for Medicaid expansion. I need your help to get it done.
Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss also weighed in today at a press conference in Milwaukee.
When you take the time to actually research it and don't use simplistic slogans, you realize very quickly that we do not want to hurt the private sector health insurance market. We do not want to raise costs. And we most importantly don't want to put the Wisconsin taxpayer at risk.
Jonah Ralston is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. Jonah, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, before we get to the policy, let's look at the politics here. Things haven't been warm and fuzzy between Governor Evers, a Democrat, and Republican leaders in the legislature. It seems to be taking a more heated tone in this last day. Do you see that?
Yeah, in fact, that may be an understatement. Of course, I think Evers came in, on the heels of that lame duck session. So that really did not set things up to be very amicable between the legislator and the governor.
And let's look at this Medicaid expansion proposal in particular. This is just one of the items, but it's a big one that Republicans say they're taking out of the governor's budget. We heard there from Governor Evers and from Assembly Leader Voss. How do we weigh, Jonah, their arguments as to the impact of accepting federal money to expand Medicaid?
Well, I think that there are strong arguments in favor of taking the expansion, at least in terms of the number of people that will be insured and how much of those costs will actually be absorbed by the federal government. I think some of the resistance in terms of what Voss is talking about may be the type of expansion that Evers is proposing. I know there's been a little bit more interest in, for example, the Arkansas model, which works through private insurance. So, in fact, it may be the type of expansion that Evers is proposing that's causing the resistance, not necessarily that it's a bad policy idea.
Do you see opportunity for both sides to come to the table and say, yes, we'll take the federal money, yes, we'll expand coverage, but we'll look at a different model? Could that be a way for both sides to inch towards each other?
Yes, potentially, although I think if you look at who's actually talking about this on the Republican side, most of those voices in favor of looking at some type of expansion are, in fact, in the state Senate, which is a bit more evenly balanced between Republicans and Democrats. If you look to the Assembly, you don't see as much discussion of this. And in fact, I think Voss, if I'm quoting him correctly, said, you know, I don't know why people are talking about it. We're not going to do it. So, you know, and the Assembly is almost two-thirds Republican. So even if a few folks in the Assembly were to, you know, peel away from the Republican side to vote in favor of an expansion, it seems unlikely you're going to get it through that chamber. So I don't know if the prospects are actually that good, even if they move to a model like Arkansas's, which would move through, through private insurance as a supplement.
And Governor Evers, as part of the campaign and since then, has gone to communities around the state. He has called his budget proposals a people's budget. He's trying, it seems like, to take the case directly to voters in Republican districts to put pressure on their elected representatives, Republican elected representatives. Is that something that could work?
Well, I think the concern for Evers here is that when the Republicans that are currently in office go up for re-election, they are, in fact, going to be using the same maps that were drawn after the 2010 census that highly favor Republicans. So they may still be electorally safe, even if these things are polling well with the general Wisconsin public.
Well, that's a nice segue into another item Republicans say they're taking out of Governor Evers' budget plan. He wanted to include a change to the way we draw our district maps, change the redistricting plan in Wisconsin, take it out of the hands of lawmakers. Is that something you think Republicans might be open to, but maybe not in the format of a budget, or is this a non-starter for them?
Yeah, you think it would be something that both may have interest in, especially given that the process for doing that is likely to be hung up because the legislature is going to draw some maps. Governor Evers will undoubtedly veto those maps, and then the courts will end up drawing the maps. And so you think there may be some vested interest here, given that the governor and the legislature are unlikely to agree on maps that will be drawn after the next census. But obviously the Republicans have benefited significantly from the current arrangement, and so maybe they are hoping for the fact that maybe the governorship will change and they, you know, can maintain the legislature. You know, there may be reasons that they're still hesitant to give up that power.
Now, we get callers on the show who are unhappy about our current system. There are definitely campaigns to change the redistricting system, but is this enough of a hot button issue that it gets a lot of voters excited to make a change?
I do think that there is interest in change, and it does seem like opinion polls have been showing there's a strong preference. You know, a number of states have already moved in this direction. Ohio and Michigan, for example, were more recent changes to more nonpartisan types of redistricting, and Iowa's often touted as a potential model. Given what they do there. So yeah, I think there is interest. Of course, the concern in our state is that we don't have the initiative or referendum process. Our referendums are just advisory. They have no actual legal or policy impact. And so without that kind of citizen pressure, I'm not sure that the legislature right now is feeling like they have to respond to this issue.
Talking to Jonah Ralston, assistant professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, looking at the state budget plan. Governor Evers made a plan. Republican leaders say they're taking a lot of it out, Medicaid expansion, and a lot more. Something that the Joint Finance Committee, though, is leaving in for now, Jonah, is a potential increase in the state's gas tax to boost funding for transportation, road building and maintenance in particular. Do you see that as a sign that there might be a solution reached on transportation funding, one that was hard to reach even with Republicans in control of the legislature and the governor's office?
Yeah, what it looks like is that, that was one of the few things that was supported by the Assembly previously. And so it looks like maybe the Assembly is having a pretty strong hand here in what happens on the Joint Finance Committee. And so since there has been support in the Assembly for that, and that the governorship has changed to a Democratic governor who is proposing this, I do think there's a window of opportunity here, particularly since it was Walker primarily that was blocking the last attempts. So there definitely is the potential here through changing that markup law and through increasing the gas tax. I think what Evers would probably like to see is that tax indexed to make sure that they don't have to go back to the table to raise it again down the road, indexing that to inflation so it would automatically increase.
Another big point of contention has been a tax cut passed by Republicans aimed at manufacturers and agricultural business owners. Democrats want to get rid of this tax cut. They say it's unfairly benefited the wealthiest Wisconsin. They've called it a tax giveaway. Republicans describe repealing it as a big tax increase. Where do you see the debate on that one?
Well, what I think it boils down to, regardless of what the actual economics are, is that the politics of it are such the Republicans strongly support this and see it as one of their kind of landmark achievements under Walker. And since they have about 75% control of that Joint Finance Committee, if you take a look at the seats, right, about 12 are Republicans and 4 are Democrats, both the chairs and vice chairs are Republican, it seems like they're going to probably write that budget in a way that favors their priorities. So I don't see there being any give on that. It seems very unlikely.
So how does this all shake out, Jonah? I mean, I won't ask you to predict the future, but we've got some serious brick walls here. It's going to be hard for the legislature to pass a budget that the governor's going to sign. It's an entirety. Where do you see this going?
Well, I think the governor is in a very tough spot, so the legislature is very likely to rewrite almost the whole thing. I mean, as you'd mentioned, most all of the proposals that Evers has put forward will, in fact, be likely to be stripped out. And so it'll be an entirely different budget that will be presented to the governor. But the governor really only has a few choices. He can line item veto a few things in it. He can reject it entirely and send them back to try to rewrite something else, or he can accept it. But if he sends it back, in fact, they may not return anything that he likes. There's no guarantees there. And if he doesn't approve it and we continue under the previous budget, that was, in fact, the last budget that Walker had approved and the Republican legislator had written into law. So I'm not really sure there's a good winning strategy for Evers here. He's in a tough spot.
Jonah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I've been talking to Jonah Ralston, assistant professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. He was with us to talk about where the state budget stands after Republicans pledged to get rid of more than 100 of Governor Evers' proposals, including a plan to accept federal money to expand Wisconsin's Medicaid program. You can share your thoughts on that part of the budget or any other. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Tell us how you hope this all works out or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. As a matter of fact, I can tell you how to get to Sesame Street because there is one now in the real world. Yesterday, New York City permanently renamed an intersection as Sesame Street. They'd done this before, but it was just temporary. For people who know their New York City geography better than I do, it is at the corner of West 63rd Street and Broadway. Incidentally, that's right by the HQ of the producers of Sesame Street. The intersection was renamed as part of the ongoing celebration of Sesame Street's 50th anniversary. The program first aired back in 1969. In November of that year, Sesame Street and public television stations are holding celebrations over the course of the year. A year after the show's debut, Time magazine featured the breakout star of the show on their cover. By that point, Big Bird had received more fan mail than any of the show's human hosts. Well, now, maybe we need to do something like this in Wisconsin. I mean, Sesame Street's already taken. We can't relocate it here. But could we name maybe a street or an intersection after some of the Sesame Street characters? Big Bird Boulevard? Maybe? Oscar the Grouch Alley? Let us know what you want to see named after Sesame Street in Wisconsin. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.